WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. The federal government estimates that households should pay no more than 30% of their pre-tax income on shelter. That's its definition of what makes housing affordable. But an increasing number of poor people, including the working poor, pay 50% and more to put a roof over their heads. And this year, the federal public housing program, which helps the poor through rent subsidies and government-built and run housing projects, received drastic cuts. In a New York Times Magazine story last month entitled The Year That Housing Died, staff writer Jason DeParl says that in legislating these cuts, the federal government has essentially conceded defeat in its decades-long drive to make housing affordable to low-income Americans, and few people took notice. DeParl plowed through pages and pages of the voluminous legislation.
I'm not sure anyone has read every word of the housing appropriations bill, but I have read what seems to me to be the most significant line, and it appears on page 29 of the accompanying report. And what it describes is the number of what are called incremental certificates and vouchers. That's a very technical phrase that will mean nothing to anyone but housing analysts. What it means is the number of new families that can get housing assistance next year. It's the premier statistic in housing. It's the one that housing advocates focus on, the way pitchers focus on a batter's batting average. It tells you everything you need to know. And this year, for the first time in modern American history, the number has fallen to zero.
So if you're getting housing assistance currently, that will continue?
Yes. It does not affect people who are currently in getting some sort of federal assistance, but it means no new families can join those ranks. And why that is significant is because the number of people waiting for housing assistance is at a record high. There are 5 million families simply on the most distressed element of the waiting list, 5 million with the highest priority. There's another 5 million on top of that who qualify for assistance, but are so far down the waiting list they really have no hope to get it.
And yet the American dream is built around this idea of safe, decent housing, of owning your own house, that somehow that's the promise of America.
Well, it's not just the promise. For most of it, it's the reality. I mean, the American housing market is the envy of the world. Anyone who's ever traveled through Japan, even briefly, can understand how lavish our housing, how splendid our housing is by the world standards, even by the standards of other wealthy countries. And 2/3 of Americans now own their own homes. It's nearly at a record level. I think it will soon become a record level. That the American housing market for most people is working very well. What we're talking about is a slice, a subset of that for whom it's working probably worse than ever, or at least worse than any modern time.
Well, let's get a little history.
Let me qualify that real quickly.
Sure.
I say worse than any time. Those of us who are in the business of talking about and writing about poverty sometimes leave the impression that things are endlessly and always and hopelessly getting worse. And I want to catch myself quickly on that point. When I say they're more troubling at any time, I'm talking about affordability. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all talking about housing quality. By historical standards, and this is important to remember, housing quality in America is better than ever. It's historically speaking, it's not that long ago that many, many Americans had severely substandard homes where they didn't have indoor plumbing, they didn't have windows, they had roofs that leaked terribly. Mostly, I mean, obviously there are examples, but mostly that really seriously substandard housing has been eradicated. That's in great progress, but it's come with a price. The price has been that housing is more expensive than ever, relatively speaking, to the income that unskilled workers can afford. And 20 years ago, there were lots of dilapidated apartments, but people could afford them. Now there are fewer affordable apartments and many more people who need them.
Well, what is then driving up the cost of rents, and what is making houses so unaffordable to so many people?
I think most of it can be explained by the old supply and demand curves. If you go back again 20 years ago when there was a surplus, 20 years ago there were more cheap apartments than there were poor people. Now there are many more poor people than there are cheap apartments. And each of those definitions, poor people and cheap apartments, comes with a kind of technical definition. But for our discussion, if we leave it at that, what happened was a lot of the cheap apartments got bulldozed. They were demolished. Others got gentrified. Others just had the normal process of rent inflation, which with utility costs in the 70s outstripped the general cost of inflation. So housing became an increasingly expensive commodity. That's on the supply side. On the demand side, wages stagnated, particularly for low-income workers. So now you have many more needy people and many fewer cheaper apartments. It's important when you think about housing, the market can respond to a poor person's purse by providing cheaper food, cheaper shoes. There's a lot of ways that in other commodities, the basic market forces can accommodate and provide a good that is less appealing but more affordable to a low-income person. With housing, there's a certain floor beneath which you can't fall. I mean, land costs, taxes, interest rates, those costs are fixed. And what there's just no way to build new apartments that are affordable to people at or below the minimum at the minimum wage or below the poverty line.
Let me shift gears here just slightly and focus on those people that can afford to buy a house. These are people that get a mortgage and property tax deduction for their efforts. Do you think of this as subsidized housing?
Of course, I don't. In my day-to-day life, I only do when I put on the hat of a housing analyst, which I think is the way most people who think about it. Most people who are listening to your show and have a mortgage don't think that they're getting a government subsidy, except for that time once a year when they sit down with their accountant, or once every 5 years when they think about buying a new place. Then they absolutely factor in the interest advantage to the mortgage. So. Yes, of course, in the world of housing policy, that is a subsubsidy.
And it's something
most of us couldn't buy our houses without that.
But I assume it's something that society is in support of, because if you own a house, it does bring a kind of stability to wherever it is that you live, that it's in society's interest for people to have stable housing.
Please don't interpret anything I'm saying as being against the mortgage interest subsidy. I just think it's important to keep in mind the amount that we spend on that versus the amount we spend on low-income housing. Sure, it accomplishes many social goods. It gives people a stake in their housing. That gives them a stake in their neighborhoods. Also, is quite a vehicle for wealth accumulation. Most people throughout the course of their lives save more money by owning a house than they do by any other means, by buying stock or putting money in the bank. So it certainly serves a lot of social goods. It's also, like things that do good, expensive. We now spend something like $65 billion a year on the mortgage interest deduction. By spend, I mean that's the cost to the tax code, the amount of money the government would otherwise have. And 2/3 of that money goes to people with incomes above $75,000. There's a kind of perverse incentive in it, which is that the more money you have, the more money the government, the more the government is willing to subsidize your mortgage. The bigger house, the more expensive house you can buy, the greater the government subsidy you get. By contrast to that $66 billion, the entire budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development is only $20 billion. So, and the $66 billion is only one of the tax advantages we give to homeowners. There's probably, if you added it all up, with things like capital gains exemptions, you're talking about subsidies to homeowners in the neighborhood of $85, $90 billion a year versus the entire low-income housing budget of about $20 billion a year.
Jason DeParle is our guest, and he's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and writes about poverty. We're talking about a cover story of a couple of weeks ago called The Year That Housing Died, and we're talking about the loss of affordable housing in this country. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason DeParle. He's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, and we're talking about a cover story he did back in the middle of October called The Year That Housing Died. Well, tell us about some of the people that you interviewed in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is really where you focused your story, and how they struggle through this. A family in particular is the family of Harold Coleman.
Well, let me start by telling you why I focused on Charlotte. And it's exactly because it isn't New York or Philadelphia or San Francisco or Chicago. It's not this kind of place that we think of as, oh, my, it's a big city and it's got every ill known to man. I mean, if any place you would think would be a manageable community when it comes to housing costs, it's Charlotte. It's a small, or at least a mid-sized southern place where housing costs have typically been low. It's also got a great economy. I mean, there's virtually no unemployment in Charlotte. There's a new 70-story skyscraper reaching toward the so high up they had to get an FAA permit to build it to make sure the planes didn't run into it. You know, it's an airport hub. It's got two new sports teams. It's booming. And it's not only got this kind of economic vitality, it also has a real tradition of civic concern. There's a lot of the city government is spending its own money on housing programs. There's a real strong Habitat for Humanity program there. In other words, if you took every possible ingredient you would like or you could imagine for a successful housing economy, Charlotte comes about as close as you could imagine. Good economy, civic concern, low housing costs, and yet. And yet, even in Charlotte, there are thousands of people, working people, who can't afford to pay the rent.
Real tale of two cities in a lot of ways.
And I was one of the things that struck me as I was reading through the city does an official housing plan every year, and even they start quoting Dickens. I mean, they're as proud as any other group of city officials about their local community, and with many reasons, you know, they have a right to be proud. They've done a lot of wonderful things in Charlotte. And yet, even when they're describing their own housing economy, they quote from A Tale of Two Cities and to describe what's happening in Charlotte.
Well, one of the families that you focus on, and I think have a great deal of affection for the way you write, is the family of Harold Coleman. Tell us how he and his family have tried to survive in Charlotte, a place, as you say, that's really probably the most receptive place in this country for people of all incomes.
Well, you know, the life of a social policy reporter is a strange thing. You swoop into people's lives for an hour or a day, and you learn all about them, and then, of course, you leave, and you don't ever see them again. And this happened to me with Harold Coleman. 5 years ago, when I first went to Charlotte, I was first time I did a housing story about Charlotte. I went there and I met this man named Harold Coleman, who was a kitchen worker in a downtown hotel making something like $5 an hour. And he had a wife and two young sons, and he was spending something like 60% of his income to keep them in an apartment. The part that leapt out to me about the story was that one day he was asleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the police came and knocked on his door, grabbed Harold Coleman, and took him off to jail. His offense was he had become an electricity pirate.
Right.
He didn't have the money to pay a down payment for the utility, so he had plugged I saw the alarm clock, plugged his alarm clock with the big red digital letters into his snake day and extension cord out his patio back door. And put it in an outside outlet that belonged to his neighbor, and his neighbor complained, and the police had come and arrested him. So, yeah, as I've gone through writing 100 stories since then, I've from time to time kind of thought back on this poor guy Harold Coleman, who'd almost become a larger than life character to me. You know, the man arrested for stealing electricity for his alarm clock,
an alarm clock that he was using to go to work.
To go to work, exactly. So I went back to Charlotte in part because I had that intriguing encounter with him, but not in the least bit expecting I would ever see him again. Or, you know, most particularly poor people tend to move so much, you know, it's hard to find them 2 months later. But I got down to Charlotte, and I looked through the phone book, and his name wasn't there. And I called the hotel where he used to work, and he wasn't there. And I was just going on finding other people, and I found the original notebook that I had carried from 5 years earlier. And there was a number in there, and I thought, well, what the heck? I picked up the phone and dialed it, never expecting, you know, never imagining that I would find him. And he answered on the first ring.
Huh. Waiting for your phone call, no
Almost as though, yeah, because he was exactly there waiting for me to call. And he was very matter-of-fact. He said, oh, yeah, well, I'm not very good with phone numbers, so we kept the same one. So a couple hours later, there I was driving up into his driveway. One of the things that struck me when I pulled up into the house was there was a kind of battered old Toyota or Honda in the driveway, and there was a radio, a license plate advertising a Christian radio station. And one of the important things in Harold and his wife's life is they've become very religious in the past 4 or 5 years. Everything seems to be turning up roses for them. They have a good new job, two healthy kids. They found a strong marriage. They belong to a church. They found the religion. Everything is going well. except for the rent.
Right.
Twice in the last 2 years, Harold and his wife have had the utilities cut off. When I say he's got a good new job, I mean, you know, he's working full time. When I found him, he was, again, most recently, he was working as an auto mechanic at the, I think, a local Western Auto and making something like $7 an hour. You know, not a good wage, but not an awful one by the standards of the local economy. I mean, far above the minimum wage. But still, it was he had gotten sick and missed a week of work, and then the car broke down and got behind on some bills. And literally twice within the last 8 months, the family had their utilities cut off. So, you know, those of us who live with a bit more margin of error in our lives, if we get sick, that's a sick day and the paycheck still comes. That didn't happen for Harold.
The tendency, I think, when looking at the crisis, as you describe it, of affordable housing in this country, is to look for people to blame. I wonder if you can point any fingers, though, to the Department of Housing, whether charges of inefficiency or corruption or an overweight bureaucracy, and point
the
to them.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development would have to be one of the fattest targets in Washington.
Sure.
If you wanted to look historically at inefficiency in bureaucracy. Sure, we could look at lots of places where HUD has, I'm not talking about this administration, I'm talking about historically, where it's been a very, going back certainly at least till 1980 when Sam Pierce came in there, you know, all kinds of mismanagement problems at HUD, and that they're still trying to, that Jack Kemp tried to dig out from, and Henry Cisneros has been trying to dig out from. All that is true. The point I'm trying to add to that is that I don't think that's the core of the nation's housing problem. You can't blame it on government efficiency. There's not a single villain. It's this intersection of housing inflation, housing costs more and more to provide, and stagnating incomes. People have less and less income. It's an economic mismatch that's at the heart of it.
One figure I read that for the government to build low-income housing, the cost per unit is something like $100,000. That seems like a lot of money to be pouring into a unit that probably doesn't have a jacuzzi and, you know, a lovely porch that wraps around it.
Another way to think about it, we started out by talking about how much it costs, or we're talking about housing vouchers and certificates, which is this year, the numbers of those voucher certificates have gone to zero for the first time this year. There are no new families being assisted. Well, why is that? The answer for why that is that housing is a uniquely expensive social program to run. Even Medicare, which is, of course, we're all worried is bankrupting the country, it costs $5,000 a year to give a person Medicare. It costs $6,000 on average to give someone a housing certificate. So it's more expensive even than Medicare.
You call this a time of, quote, post-entitlement balance budget world, that we live in a world of post-entitlement balance budget. And I assume one of the reasons that public housing was targeted was that every, like all government programs, everyone's got to take a hit in order to balance the budget. Is a balanced budget good for poor people?
Well, let me amend that slightly. We don't yet live in a post-entitlement balanced budget world. We're talking about trying to get to one. And I think what's interesting about housing is that it offers a glimpse of what that might look like, in that housing has never been an entitlement. And now as we try to get toward a balanced budget, we have to take these deep housing cuts. What that means is only one in three people who qualify for the housing assistance can actually get it. Two out of three people who qualify are simply stuck on a waiting list. I think we would never run, or at least we never have run a medical program that way. You wouldn't say that one of three, all elderly people qualify for Medicare, but only one in three is going to get it. That would obviously not fly, but that is the circumstance that applies in housing. Your question was whether I think a balanced budget is good for poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Low interest rates are good for poor people, sure. I mean, Harold Coleman has a car payment. That helps him. I mean, high inflation hurts, high interest rates hurt poor people. Yes, that is that's one of the things that you have to, you can't just keep spending and spending money. You have to think about the effect of fiscal responsibility, that has a beneficial effect that poor people share in as well. I think one question you do need to ask, though, is in a time, if you're going to do deficit reduction, do you do it in a way that spreads burdens fairly? And if you look at the what we've done so far, almost all the savings have come from the poorest Americans. And we just went through last year, we had a huge year-long debate about how to reduce the deficit, and we talked about Medicare savings, and we talked about this and that. The only thing that actually got done was $55 billion worth of cuts in anti-poverty programs that targeted disabled children, that targeted immigrants, that targeted people on welfare. Again, going back to the mortgage interest questions, we'd spend something like $90 billion subsidizing housing for the affluent and $20 billion subsidizing it for the poor. And when we decide that we have to save money, we start with the $20 billion we're spending on the poor.
Jason DePaul is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more about the crisis in affordable housing in the second part of the show. DePaul's cover story on the issue was featured in the magazine in October. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. Jason DePaul is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and covers poverty for the publication. We're talking about a cover story he wrote in October about the crisis in affordable housing. He says with rising rents and falling wages, more poor people are paying more of their money for shelter. I wonder if you can look at the private sector or look at programs like Habitat for Humanity or some nonprofit groups that you write about in your article and to say, well, perhaps the federal government can only do so much or spend only so much money, but perhaps the private sector can step in and do the rest. Is that possible based on your analysis, your observations of the affordable housing crisis?
No, I don't think it's possible that you're going to see the charitable sector come in with enough kinds of subsidies to make a big difference. I mean, in Charlotte, Habitat for Humanity, Charlotte has the second most active Habitat for Humanity, or second most productive chapter in the country. They build more houses in Charlotte than they have anywhere in the country besides Atlanta. But they've only built 250 houses in 10 years. I mean, they're wonderful houses, and it's a great program, and it makes your soul sing to go look at them and see people have these homes that they've helped build and they can now live in. But when you step back and think that there are 3,000 people on the waiting list and you're building something like 20 homes a year, I don't think you can really point to that as saying that the private sector can do this on its own. What I do think you can say is that there can be a mix. There has to be, I think, to make housing programs work, some public government subsidy. But there are lots of examples of private management, private contributions, public-private partnerships, including in Charlotte, that where you're not just setting up a big public bureaucracy like we did with public housing and saying, let the government run it and often run it into the ground. I think you're talking about providing an initial subsidy with some kind of matching grant and having these there's a whole infrastructure of nonprofit housing groups that have grown up, and it's early in the movement. They've only been at this for 10 or 15 years. We don't know what their projects will look like 40 years down the road, but so far the results have really been encouraging.
I wonder what you anticipate the effect of the changes in the welfare program that were signed into law this year, where there's a time limit after 5 years. Those people on welfare are going to have to get some kind of job. I assume many of these people will find, if they're lucky enough to find jobs, will find them at minimum wage. Throw them then into the housing market. How are they going to survive?
Well, I think the welfare bill raises two kinds of questions. One is what happens to the people who don't get the jobs. So to start there, imagine you're running a public housing program and the people in these apartments already have quite little money. Some of them are relying on welfare checks of, say, $300 a month. What happens when that $300 a month goes to zero? Well, your ability to collect rent goes even lower. So in most of these public housing units are already running the government provides, it's interesting the way this works. Every year the government says, makes an estimate of how much it would cost to run public housing for the year, say $3 billion. Then it provides less than that, say 2.5. Every year it's a percentage. You know, so by the government's own estimates, it's providing less than it costs to keep those programs, to keep those apartments maintained. So what you see is a steady deterioration over time. And that's just going to accelerate when the incomes of the people in those projects decline further. That's for the people who don't succeed, for the people who stay in public housing. For the people who are able to go out and get jobs and move out, you have a different set of questions. How are they going to afford a place to live in this economy where where plenty of people with incomes at the $6 and $7 an hour level are still paying 50% of their income for shelter.
This may be an unfair question, and it's clear that there are no villains in this story of the lack of affordable housing, nor are there simple solutions.
It's the worst kind of story to try to tell, and it's probably one reason why it doesn't get told. You know?
Well, if perhaps, again, this is an unfair question, but if you could fix it, if you could fix the problem, and I know you can't, how would you do that? Where would you go first?
I think part of what the government doing right now makes sense, which is to try to fix the worst symbols of part of the reason we don't spend more money on housing is that people don't believe it would do any good. And the reason they don't believe it would do any good is because when they think of subsidized housing, they think of big city housing projects and they think of failure and waste. So Henry Cisneros hopes that if he can go to the 40 biggest cities in the country and take down the worst of these buildings and replace them with developments that seem to work as viable communities, that can be the beginning of building a constituency of political support for housing programs. So both programmatically and politically, I think that's one good place to start.
Would you also want to continue and extend and add to then the rent subsidies and to look at the millions of people who don't even qualify at this? I mean, who do qualify but can't get in the program?
Well, certainly spending, if I had an extra billion to put in the housing budget, I would certainly want some of it to go to the Section 8 program, which is the cheapest or the fastest and most efficient way to get people housing. And also by giving it, the subsidy to the person rather than to a project, it gives them the buzzword would be it empowers them. Mm-hmm. It allows them to go if they don't like where they live, they can get up and move. And there have been some very interesting housing experiments with that people have been very successful in getting out of these big city ghettos and into suburban neighborhoods, better jobs, better schools, because they can actually take the subsidy and go find a more decent place to live. So I'm very enthusiastic about that subset of housing programs. They're called mobility programs. They give poor people the subsidies themselves and allow them to go out and try to find a better life.
I'm curious whether you think your articles in the New York Times Magazine, which has very glossy ads, there's usually a section on very expensive fashions, whether you want well-off people in this country to either be uncomfortable with their luck in life or to rethink their relationship to poor people or to rethink their relationship to the government?
Well, did you say, do I want them to be unhappy?
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, I suppose people who go into the business of poverty reporting at some in some dark recess of their mind have the hope that our writing will make the comfortable uncomfortable and comfort those with who have little. Not in a literal sense in that I think there's anything wrong with working hard and enjoying the fruits of your labor, but perhaps in a psychological sense, I think those of us who are more privileged. As we go about our lives day to day, we tend to think that we've earned everything we get. And when you step back, life seems a little bit more, at least to have a little bit more of a lottery aspect to it. Not entirely, but there's some of what we get we earn, and some of what we get by dint of good luck. And it's, I think, helpful to be reminded of that.
Well, Jason DePauw, we're going to end on that note, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jason DePauw is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. His cover story on the crisis in affordable housing appeared in October. This is Fresh Air.